friend of mine as our next presenter, Dr. Wes Youngberg.
Are you as sleep deprived as I am?
I'm jet lagged, just like you. And we came in on the same flight.
That's right.
Dr. Youngberg is works in California at a major medical clinic as the lifestyle director. And he's very involved in preventive care. And we're delighted that he can be here and he can talk about lifestyle strategies for diabetes. Are you going to talk anything about the incidence and what's going on?
Mainly about genetic transformation.
About the genetics. If you're not aware, in many parts of the world, and certainly the part we come from, diabetes is skyrocketing. And it's a significant problem that the population is dealing with. And he is going to share a little bit about some exciting new areas of not only discovery, but also of treatment. Thank you, Wes, for being here.
Thank you, Dr. Harding. I am listening to Fred's presentation earlier this afternoon. I was feeling kind of bad because I've been up since 1 this morning. So I've been up a long time, and I'm wondering if I'm going to make any blunders here in this presentation. But my saving grace is that I went to bed at 10 o'clock. And we know because of the melatonin pathways that if you go to bed earlier before midnight, you get, 2 hours for every hour before midnight? And so at least I have a little bit of extra melatonin floating around, even though I'm feeling a little punch drunk at the moment. Well, I want to share with you my perspectives on the opportunity that we have to share the good news of transformation at a genetic level for the diabetic patient or for an individual who has a family history of diabetes and is concerned about what might be happening in their future. I had the privilege to learn under the mentorship of Dr. Charles Brinegar, first working with him in Sun City with the Loma Linda Faculty Medical Group some 20 years ago. And then when we were able to convince him to come to Guam as the director of a diabetes treatment center associated with the SDA Guam Wellness Center. Now, I learned a lot from Dr. Brinegar, and I had the privilege to work with Dr. Hornucci, who's here today. And so I'm going to share with you a little bit what we learned over the last 20 years, and especially what we're learning in the last few years of what is possible. But first, let's ask the question, what is diabetes? It might seem obvious to you, but I ask this question every single time I do a presentation in a 10-week-long diabetes management clinic. It meets 2 hours once a week, and it goes 10 weeks, and patients can get involved in it at any given time and just go 10 weeks. It's based on the DIGMA model, which means it's an individual medical appointment done in a group setting. And I ask this question at the beginning of every single session, what is diabetes? And most people don't get this right the first couple times. Because diabetes is a blood sugar that is so high that it causes serious complications. That's really, in my mind, the most functional definition of diabetes. Understanding that it is a blood sugar that is so high that it leads to serious polyopathies, multiple pathologies, unless we do something aggressive to treat it. In 1997, I had the chance of working with Dr. Charles Brinegar and coming up with a model, an educational and clinical tool that would help us better define and detect diabetes and prediabetes at the earliest levels. Because if our goal is to prevent the complications of diabetes, we need to make sure that we're catching its tendency as early as possible. And here are what we call the 5 stages of high blood sugar. And you'll see here in the fasting column that optimal blood sugars are between 70 and 84. Now, typically when somebody goes in for the yearly physical and they get their fasting glucose done as part of the overall chem panel, Oftentimes, their blood sugars are actually just above 100, but that goes unrecognized, even though for the last 10 years, we've known that pre-diabetes begins at 100. And then diabetes beginning at stage 5 of these stages of high blood sugar at 126 or 7 nanomoles per liter. So, the key here is also recognizing that diabetes is not diagnosed effectively if we just look at the fasting glucose or fasting blood sugar levels. Many studies, including in teenagers, adults of all ages, show that if you check a 2-hour blood sugar after a meal, after a sugar drink, after a glucose drink in the lab, that is far more likely to help you diagnose pre-diabetes or any of the stages of elevated blood sugar compared to the fasting blood sugar. And so in this model, you'll see at the 2-hour level, once you hit a 2-hour blood glucose level of 140 or greater, that represents pre-diabetes. And you're far more likely to catch it at the 2-hour level than you are at the fasting or pre-meal level. Likewise, you're far more likely to catch diabetes with a 2-hour post-glucose or post-meal blood sugar of 200 or greater. All right. Now, what are the underlying causes of diabetes? Before we get into the new research on genetic transformation, what are the core causal factors associated with diabetes? Well, the most common one that's been discussed a lot already in this conference is insulin resistance. This is where the muscle itself is resistant to the effect of insulin and storing sugar from the blood into the cell. But it also occurs in the liver. The liver becomes very resistant to absorbing sugar that's in the bloodstream. And so the level of sugar stays higher and higher in the bloodstream when the liver is not able to absorb that. And so people who have early signs of liver disease, even before the liver enzymes or the transaminase levels go up, can actually lead to problems with diabetes and prediabetes. One of the reasons obesity is such a risk factor for diabetes is because it's also a major risk factor for non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. You're more likely to get liver disease from obesity than you are from alcohol, at least in terms of public health numbers. There's far more damage to livers in this world from obesity than there is from alcohol. And that's a stat that's difficult to swallow, but it's true. Also, when we're eating richly, when we're not being careful to consume meals in a balanced, healthful way, that actually stimulates the production of what's called endogenous alcohol in the blood, in the body. And so we start taking in alcohol from the way our food is fermenting because we're not eating moderately. And so there's people that would be willing to castigate somebody who is having one beer once in a while when in fact they are themselves making far more alcohol simply because of the way they eat. So it's just something to think about, and especially as we are looking at ways to help people improve their health in a positive way. Other factors include pancreatic dysfunction, where the beta cells of the pancreas are essentially just getting tired out. They're tired of having to run a marathon every day, every week, month after month. They get fatigued over time by having to work so hard to make enough insulin to try to compensate for the resistance of the muscle and the liver to insulin. Autoimmune conditions are a growing epidemic as it relates to diabetes and all kinds of other chronic lifestyle-related conditions. And we'll be learning more about that. And then finally, adrenal dysfunction. When when we're stressed out and the adrenal glands are trying to keep up and they go through phases of inactivity where they're not producing enough adrenaline or cortisol, and then they'll go through phases where they're producing too much. And of course, cortisol and adrenaline do what? They tell the liver to release sugar. And that is why a lot of diabetics will find that their blood sugars are higher in a fasting state than they are the rest of the day, even after meals. So they can't comprehend, I haven't eaten anything for 12 hours. How can my blood sugar be higher now in the morning before I eat breakfast than the rest of the day, even an hour or 2 hours after eating? And the reason is because the liver is responding to the adrenaline and the cortisol being released by the adrenal glands because they're dysfunctional. They're either making too much or too little, creating a lot of trauma in the body. The what I call the transforming tests in diabetes management and early detection of diabetes and prediabetes includes a 2 or up to a 4 hour glucose tolerance test. If people are finding that they're waking up in the middle of the night and they can't go back to sleep, oftentimes, that is a sign of reactive hypoglycemia. The blood sugars have gone up initially after the evening meal, only to come crashing down some hours later. And the adrenal gland, because again, it's not functional, it's not hardy enough to support the blood sugars all through the night, don't kick in right away, allowing the blood sugars to drop too low, and then they go into alarm mode and they produce lots of adrenaline, which then what? It wakes you up and you're revved up and you can't go back to sleep. So that would be the situation where we check a 4 hour glucose tolerance test. Then we also check insulin at fasting in 2 hours, because the first sign of a dysregulation of metabolism is not an elevated blood sugar at 1 or 2 hours or fasting. It is an elevated insulin level. And this is very important. Dr. James Bernard and others from UCLA Medical Center, working in conjunction with the Pritikin Longevity Center, have shown for the last 20 years that when insulin levels are high, it creates all kinds of metabolic dysfunctions. Dr. Gerald Reaver from Stanford has been talking about this for over 30 years, saying the main cause of high blood pressure, up to 80% of all high blood pressure, comes from a dysregulation of insulin, an elevated insulin, which basically stimulates the high blood pressure. So essential hypertension is largely related to hyperinsulinemia. And so it's a very functional and effective test to measure with patients, both fasting and at 2 hours. All right, and then the other thing to be aware of is that many times in clinical evaluation, the laboratory norms say little about the clinical reality. Back before 1984, if your cholesterol was 315, it would have come back as normal, because the normal range, the normal distribution of cholesterol is 130 to 320. But they changed those norms to make them into a clinically optimal range. And the same needs to be true for other labs. And so even though fasting insulin values are frequently well above 20 in patients, the optimal is 4 to 9. So be aware of that as you look at the literature. Elevated insulin increases inflammation. We'll tie that in a little bit later. There's a lot of research showing that as you elevate inflammation, as measured by the cardiac CRP, that leads to all kinds of problems. Cancers, Alzheimer's, on and on. And elevated insulin is one of the things that promotes inflammation. Of course, inflammation also promotes elevated insulin. And then we have the hemoglobin A1C, which is a key test that we measure in diabetes. And I'll just briefly mention that the A1C level, looking at the average blood sugar over the last 3 to 4 months, is an indication of how high the blood sugars have been on average. And so a hemoglobin A1C of 12%, how much sugar is sticking to the proteins on the cell membranes, represents an average blood sugar of 300 milligrams per deciliter. Whereas an optimal hemoglobin A1C of 5, a non-diabetic optimal level of 5%, represents an average blood sugar around 80. But each increment from 5 to 6%, which is usually the beginning of diabetes, represents a 35% increased risk of complications. And so this is huge, because when you apply a comprehensive lifestyle medicine approach to dealing with diabetes, you don't get just a 1 or 2% drop in an elevated A1C. You oftentimes get 3, 4%. The goal is to optimize, always to optimize, to do the best that we can and keep bringing this down by adding strategy upon strategy. And we're going to be sharing a couple of those with you this afternoon. So in addition, every 1% you drop that A1C blood test, you lower the risk of premature death by 25%. There's great potential with lifestyle intervention in working with the diabetic. In fact, far more potential than there is with the traditional pharmaceutical approaches. You can combine them effectively as well, but the foundation must be lifestyle therapy, or else ultimately there's going to be complications and serious ones. Have you ever heard this? Well, we can't reverse the disease. You can only manage it. You're going to be taking this medicine for the rest of your life. Those are statements that actually drown out joy in people's lives. It steals hope from them when they hear these messages from us or from other health providers or health educators. The research actually strongly suggests that this is no longer the paradigm, and we need to make sure that we're following the newer paradigms. Well, as I mentioned, I'm involved in a 10-week diabetes management clinic where we have anywhere from 10 to 25 patients that come in any given day, either in the morning or in an evening session. And during that time, they have an opportunity to spend 20 hours learning about how to effectively manage diabetes using lifestyle interventions. I frequently talk about the concept of potentially reversing diabetes. And real quickly, a few years ago, 2004, the president of the Guam Medical Association asked me to give a talk and call it Reversing Diabetes with Nutrition. Now, this was 5 years ago, and even today there is squeamishness when we use the term reversal or cure relative to diabetes. Understandably so, because we're all trained, at least those of us that are 40 and over, we're trained that you really couldn't do that. And so it invokes a little bit a sense of misinformation or quackery when you use this term. So, but I basically presented an hour-long presentation on this in front of about 400 people during a plenary session. At the end of the presentation, the chairman of the scientific panel got up, a nephrologist, and he said, "I just want to go on record saying I disagree with what Dr. Youngberg was saying today about the potential to reverse diabetes." And he says, "You know, this scientific presentations, we need to be open and dialogue and share our perspectives on this." So he was very gracious and very appropriate in talking about how he felt. But he was sharing exactly how most of us were trained. Fortunately, because the audience had become very quiet by that time, wondering how I would respond. And so I was waiting for an opening, something that I could find a way to bring this back without a confrontation. And he says, "There was a researcher just before me who had presented on the future of genetic engineering as it related to diabetes. He was a geneticist. And so the physician commenting on before the question and answer session said possibly in the future through genetic engineering this there may be a possibility. And that was my opening. And I said, thank you, doctor, for sharing what we all struggle with, the old paradigms. The problem is that the old paradigm steals hope from our patients, and if we tell them they can't get better, they're not going to try. They're not going to look for any answers. They're not going to look for the strategies, even though the strategies are more and more becoming available. And I said, but I'm glad you mentioned about genetic engineering, because that is exactly what occurs through lifestyle interventions that are broad and brought together in an integrated fashion. The genes are literally transformed when we do that. And let me share with you some of the concepts on that. During the presentation, I'd share just a video clip from this documentary, Supersize Me, where a surgeon, a bariatric surgeon, was actually explaining how gastric stapling surgery was the only procedure known, proven to reverse and cure diabetes. I'd shared that with the audience. 2 days later, I was listening to the news on the way to work, and it was a report at the Journal of the American Medical Association in October of 2004, had just published a meta-analysis of thousands and thousands of individuals who'd gone through gastric bypass surgery and found that after a year of evaluating these patients, 77% of them had completely resolved their diabetes. Of those who initially had fully diagnosed diabetes, more than three-fourths of individuals with diabetes were able to reverse it through gastric bypass surgery. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not here promoting gastric bypass. I don't promote it. But the value of the study for those of us who are proponents of lifestyle medicine is that finally we have a definitive study, a huge study published in JAMA that shows that diabetes is reversible and in a very significant, powerful way. Now, what were the determining factors in terms of establishing whether there was a cure or not? The American Diabetes Association just this year, in the last few months, has established a task force to look at this question. How do we determine whether or not somebody's been cured of diabetes or even pre-diabetes? And essentially, this earlier research 5 years ago published in JAMA really sets the stage for that. Essentially, the first question is, what are the diagnostic criteria for diagnosing diabetes in the first place? It's not difficult. It's one simple thing. Are your blood sugars before breakfast at 126 or higher, or at 7 nanomoles or higher, or 2 hours after a meal, is your glucose above 200 milligrams per deciliter? That's the criteria for diagnosing diabetes, and the only criteria. And so, why can't we use that criteria for determining whether somebody has actually now reversed diabetes? I mean, they didn't have it to begin with. It's just like somebody gradually gains weight, and they now meet the criteria based on BMI or weight for obesity. If they're 100 pounds overweight, and now they've lost 100 pounds, they're no longer obese. You wouldn't say, well, you're technically still obese. You're just managing it well. No, you wouldn't say that. You're not obese anymore. You no longer meet the definition of obesity. And that should be true for diabetes. As long as the resolution of hyperglycemia, of elevated blood sugars, has occurred without the need for medical intervention and is sustained over months, 3 months, 6 months, a year, that hasn't been defined yet. So we have the criteria available to us to actually share with people that there is a potential to reverse diabetes. Now, it's important to note that some people, because of the actual causative factors contributing to their diabetes, are going to have a much harder time controlling their blood sugars. And that includes what we call latent autoimmune diabetes, which is hardly ever tested for, even though it's more and more common. And a group of Australian researchers just recently, this past year, established several criteria for evaluating whether or not somebody is probably a latent autoimmune type diabetic. And that includes onset before age 50, acute symptoms, and here's key, if they're normal weight and if they have a family or personal history of autoimmune disease, any two of those risk factors suggest, based on the Australian data, that there's a 90% probability that they actually have an autoimmune-related diabetes, which is going to be much harder to treat. But lifestyle interventions are even more important for them because they have more to gain from that over time, because the autoimmune disease just keeps getting worse over time. And so the earlier you intervene on that, the more you're able to slow down that autoimmune disease. And hopefully, as we begin to understand it better from a lifestyle medicine perspective, reverse that process. How much time we got? Five, okay. All right. Well, I'm about a fifth of the way through. Let's see here. I will skip to this. But we say oftentimes, you know, it's I got bad genes. My Aunt Mary had diabetes. My grandfather had diabetes. I have both sides of the family. Normally, people don't think of that or don't even think it's a problem for them until when? Until they get diagnosed and they go, oh, well, it's just genetic. I mean, they didn't have it before. They didn't have it before, so how can it be purely a genetic issue? Well, let me quickly tell you the story of the fat yellow mouse. Researchers have looked at the agouti mouse strain, which basically has a yellow coat, as you can see, and the same chromosome where the genes code for a yellow coat also has genes that code for risk for diabetes at a significant level, risk for cancer and obesity. And what they did is says, what if we fed them superfoods, functional foods, foods high in nutrients? Could we possibly change the gene? And what they found is when they fed these fat yellow mama mice superfoods, rich in folic acid and B12 and other key nutrients that have what we call methyl donors in them, within a very short time, these fat yellow mama mice were giving birth to brown, lean baby mice that did not go on to develop diabetes, obesity, or cancer. And so they thought, wow, we changed the gene. In fact, these mice are identical twins. They're genetically identical, but they are very different health-wise. As the researchers looked at the gene, they couldn't see any difference at all. But as they looked outside of the gene, they saw a trigger, a mechanism that actually had the potential to turn off that disease-causing gene. And that is the birth of epigenetics. That is the birth of the potential to transform genetics in our favor. The level of nutrients in the diet, as they became more nutritionally dense, more healthy, the genetically identical mice became leaner and browner and healthier. This is something that we can do ourselves as well. Okay, I need to skip through here. Another quick study done by Dr. Dean Ornish, the geminal study that looked at gene expression modulation by intervention with nutrition and lifestyle, just published last year in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and he took men who had early stage prostate cancer, did biopsies on them and tested over 500 genes, and he found that 48 of the genes that had the potential to prevent disease had been turned off, and now after 3 months of lifestyle intervention are turned on. 453 genes, which typically promoted disease, had been turned on, but now after 3 months are turned off. Do you see the power of genetic transformation here? 3 months, and it probably happened much quicker than that. In fact, the lifestyle intervention that Dr. Dean Ornish followed was, number one, a plant-based diet. Number two, a moderate exercise program, stress management techniques, and group support. That was it. That was the structure of integrative lifestyle intervention. So the key theme here is that we need to learn how to transform our physical and emotional well-being. That on a spiritual level, I share this slide with every single group, secular or otherwise, and that is the power of transformation. This statement written down by the Apostle Paul many, many years ago to his friends in Rome, says, do not conform any longer to the ways of this world, but be ye what? Transformed by the renewing of your mind. This statement transcends spirituality, gets into psychology, physiology. It's something that can resonate with anybody, regardless of their worldview. I want to thank Bill Knott, my friend Bill, who's here in the audience today, for his vision and foresight in providing leadership at the Adventist Review that is embracing lifestyle medicine, that is embracing the health ministries. It's not just leaving this area to the health journals, but is recognizing that health is holistic and integrated and involves spiritual, emotional, social, and physical. And I especially want to point out how much I appreciated his statement in his editorial, where he used 3 John 1. It says, to Gaius, my dear friend, whom I love in the truth. Dear friend, I hope all is well with you and that you are as healthy in body as you are strong in spirit. This points out that one of the most important things with regards to transformational healing is relationship. We cannot have optimal transformational healing at the genetic level unless we first understand how to accept love, how to accept forgiveness, and how to share those qualities with others. And I think that this past issue of the Adventist Review helped really bring that to the forefront, so thank you very much for that. Okay, my time is up, so let me go to the end and miss all this good stuff that you're not going to get. but it's going to be in the PowerPoints for you. Let me just say one word about vitamin D. There's literally thousands of studies on vitamin D out now. And I've had the privilege to go to 2 international conferences on vitamin D. And if you are not aware of the power of vitamin D in sunlight, is one of the key healing remedies that we've read about for many, many decades and yet really not paid as much attention to as we should, make sure that you're testing your blood levels of vitamin D. Make sure that you're getting them up to optimal levels, because I guarantee you, if you haven't tested yourself, there's a 90% chance you're low. I've been there. Okay, and don't think because you're out in the sun a little bit that your vitamin D is going to be good, because it doesn't work that way very easily. So I want to recommend a book to you, The Vitamin D Prescription. It's actually written by a colleague of mine at the Rancho Family Medical Group. who just published in the last 2 months, it's available on Amazon. It has all the data that you need to be aware of to optimize not only your own health, your own cancer risk, diabetes risk, etc., because vitamin D levels very much related to both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and most everybody is low. So God bless, and if you want to learn more about this, there's more information on www.healthypeopleconference.org, and that's also going to be in the PowerPoints as well.